Hello, you with Truth News Radio Australia. It's Australia Day, the 26th of January 2010. Today I'm bringing you an interview with one of the most important and distinguished climate change skeptics, Lord Monckton, coming up in just a couple of minutes. I'm really pleased to have been able to get this interview. Lord Monckton is currently on a tour, and he's going to be speaking in a number of places around Australia, and he's graciously agreed to come on our show. So really, really important interview, and I hope you're able to copy this and get it out to everyone. I'm going to be focusing on some of the key issues and hopefully add a bit to the discussion, because there's so many sides to this debate, so many ways we can look at it. And I think the more discussion, the more incisive questioning that we get, the better we can explain to the general public what the fundamental errors are in the anthropogenic climate change position. And then we can get to the point where we can explain the more sinister agenda behind climate change science, which is really what we're focused on, because we're trying to protect and defend freedom and democracy. So, really important show. So please stand by, and we'll be bringing you Lord Monckton momentarily. Well, it's my great pleasure this morning to welcome to Truth News Radio Lord Christopher Monckton. Lord Monckton is the third Viscount of Brenchley and was special advisor to Margaret Thatcher as UK Prime Minister from 1982 to 1986. And more importantly, Lord Monckton is one of the most important and distinguished people that are speaking out against the anthropogenic climate change pseudoscience, as we like to say on this show. And even more importantly than that, he is one of the great defenders of freedom and democracy in the world, because there is an agenda, as we've been saying many times on Truth News Radio Australia, there is an agenda behind the science of anthropogenic climate change, which, for all the faults and flaws of the science, the agenda here is an anti-democratic one. And that is where we find that we must take a very strong stand. And this is one which I think really, it has nothing to do with traditional left and right of politics. It goes to much deeper principles of truth and justice. So I just want to say, Lord Monckton, welcome to the show.
Well, what a splendid introduction. I hardly need to say anything else. You've said it all for me.
Yeah, look, thanks a lot. Thanks so much for making the time to come on our show. This is really a grassroots podcast show, but we have quite a few people out there who listen, and many people are very aware of your work. And I think... what I'd really like to do, there's a few areas I'd like to focus on in this interview, one being the scientific issues, the other being the main area, of course, being the agenda behind those issues. But before we get into all that, I was wondering if you could just give us an outline of how you came to become an anthropogenic climate change skeptic, and what were the steps that you went through? Because I often find that that personal side of it often helps people to understand, and to, because we really want to communicate to as many people as possible.
Well, that's quite a neat approach, and I started out by being concerned about this potential problem myself, because when I was working for Margaret Thatcher in her policy unit, and I was the member of it who gave her advice usually on scientific matters, I'd come across in the literature the concern that was being expressed in some quarters in those days in a proportionate and sensible manner on the whole about the possibility that adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere at the rate that we were and still are adding it might ultimately cause undue warming, which could disturb planetary systems to some extent. I thought that Margaret Thatcher ought to know about this. I did brief her about it, and a couple of years later, after I had left Number 10, this would have been 1988, my successor there, George Guise, went to Chequers, which is the Prime Minister's country retreat, one weekend. It was a bitterly cold night in October, and he and Margaret Thatcher chuckled to each other as they threw logs on the fire to keep themselves warm,
right,
while writing the speech about global warming that she eventually gave to the Royal Society, announcing that she was going to provide government funding for what came the Hadley Centre for Forecasting, so that we in Britain could produce, as it were, an independent assessment of whether or not there was a real problem, because my advice had been advice which she did take, that it was better that we should find out about this than get caught by it when it was too late. So I started out, I think, reflecting a proper and careful scientific approach, which is a flag had been raised by one or two scientists. We ought to check it out just to make sure what the scale of the problem was so that we could then decide what to do about it. Now, I then really didn't look at the matter again for about 20 years because I fell very sick and was more or less out of action. And I got better about 18 months ago, but shortly before I got better, I was approached by a city institution which said, look, our financial analysts don't know what to make of the way the global warming scare is now becoming much bigger and more people seem to be worried about it. And we need to know, is it a scare or is it the real thing? Is there a real problem? And we're asking various people, one of whom is you, can you please get back to us and let me know your thoughts? So I spent a month researching it and sent in a 40-page report to the bank saying, yes, there was thought to be a problem. I myself had thought there might be a problem. It was now clear, this was about 3 years ago, it was now clear that the problem didn't actually exist on any scale that we needed to worry about. Yes, CO2 is a greenhouse gas. Yes, it therefore causes warming. But no, the amount we're adding to the atmosphere basically can't cause very much warming. And so what I said was, it looks to me as though the scientific community, along with various governments and the news media, were finding it socially convenient, politically expedient, or financially profitable to pretend to the general public, which largely doesn't know any science, that there was a far bigger problem than in fact there is, and that therefore the public had to be saved from itself by being made to pay massive taxes, massive extra prices for its electricity and its gasoline, and also made to shut down the heaviest industries in mining and in smelting and so forth, which were big emitters of CO2. Effectively, my advice was that this was a scheme targeted, as you rightly say, at democracy, at freedom, and at the West, and that therefore it needed very careful watching, and we needed to try to find a way of demonstrating both scientifically and economically what the truth of this matter was, rather than what we were being told the truth of the matter was.
Excellent, excellent. Thanks for that. And so when you're while you're here in Australia, you're going to be speaking in a number of locations, and I think your first public event is tomorrow, is that correct?
That's right. It's going to be at the Sheraton on the Park, which is at 316 Elizabeth Street, which is on the park itself, more or less opposite Mary's Cathedral on the other side of the park. And it's in the Grand Ballroom there, and we're expecting, I think, a few hundred people to come. And so do please come to that, because it is open to the public. Everybody is welcome, and we'd very much like to see you there.
Yeah, well, I think there will be a lot of people there, although unfortunately, and I've been going through the press coverage of your visit, and perhaps not surprisingly, it hasn't been particularly warm or sympathetic.
I certainly wasn't expecting to be welcomed by the media in Australia in particular, because the media here tend to be almost entirely captured by a single, narrow, and if I may say, rather poisonous political faction, which doesn't tolerate alternative opinions. Now, it seems to me that as a Democrat, and I start where you do, thinking that democracy is a rare, wonderful, and precious flower that we must not let wither.
Indeed.
in a democracy, whether or not you agree with somebody's point of views, it is fair enough that that guy be allowed to speak. I've been invited here by people who share my concern and yours that perhaps this is being oversold as a problem. That is a point of view which, whether or not you agree with it, is one which is statable. It's reasonable to say it. And I don't think that the kind of very much ad hominem coverage that I'd had, that's attacking me personally rather than trying to attack the argument, is actually going to impress anyone in Australia very much. One of the things I've begun to find is that because I am among the most prominent of the people worldwide who are saying the emperor has no clothes on this particular story, I do attract perhaps more than my fair share of extremely venomous and hostile comment from the people who wish the world to believe this particular nonsense about the climate. And what is now beginning to happen is that though they don't realize it, they're acting as recruiting sergeants for the truth, because people can see the sheer venom, the sheer poison, the sheer nastiness of what's being said about me would not be appropriate if I were merely misunderstanding the science in some way and simply making a mistake. And they're only doing it because basically they're in effect admitting that I'm right, that they dare not argue against me on the science because they can't. And therefore they attack me personally in the hope that they will discredit me sufficiently in the eyes of the powers that be in the establishment that nobody in the end will pay any heed. But this is no longer working, even if it ever did. The sheer shrillness of the shrieking and the screaming and the yelling of these people in the left wing end of the media, if you like,
yes,
to use a sort of generic term, is now acting against their interest and in favor of the truth. Because people who perhaps don't know the science one way or the other and see the way that they are attacking me, not on the science, but on personality all the time, they're beginning to get in touch with me and say, well, we've seen this about you. We think that it's so nasty that if you're still here, it can't be right. And therefore, we'd like to know more about why you say what you say. And I then refer them to our website or to my published writings on the subject. And they come back to me and they say, my goodness, we had no idea there was actually a serious other side to this subject. So I don't mind that the commentary in Australia has gone the way it has. I warned those who had kindly invited me here that this is exactly what would happen and that they should not be worried by it either. And indeed, they're delighted, in fact, because it's merely leading to packed meetings everywhere. I mean, we've sold out in most places.
Yeah, look, there's a huge... There's a kind of a polarisation occurring in our society, and I think it's happening in other countries around the world too. The general public is waking up, while the leaders, the rulers, and the media are basically still steering the same line. And we're seeing this separation because, I mean, you were on the Alan Jones show, 2GB, yesterday, yeah, which I had listened to, and that's a very popular show. And, you know, there are probably millions of people in this country who already are aware of what you're saying and know it's true.
Well, I think Alan Jones is one of the most impressive interviewers I've ever come across. He does his research meticulously before he even talks to a guest, and then he asks a string of the most intelligent questions to get the best out of the guest. He's one of the most impressive interviewers I've come across. So it was a great pleasure to be on his show, and of course he does reach, I think, 70 radio stations right across Australia. So we are looking at an audience in the millions just for that program. And I think you're right. People are therefore getting to hear something of our side of the message on this, and they're beginning to be able to weigh up whether what they hear from me when I'm allowed to give that side of the story makes any sense. Because I take the approach that I'm not asking anyone to believe a single word I say, because science is not a belief system. It is a rigorous process of inquiry and checking and verification and checking again and again and again. That's how science is done. And so if I say any given thing about the climate, I don't expect to be believed. After all, I'm a layman. I'm not even a scientist. I do, in fact, have quite a good knowledge of mathematics, which is the language of science. I therefore read the scientific papers on the subject with relative facility, and I understand most of what I read in them. But that doesn't make me a scientist, because I have no qualification to say so. But I do think you're quite right. What we've got here is indeed a conspiracy of the government against the governed, of the rich against the poor, of the strong against the weak, of the powerful against the helpless, of the big guy against the little guy. And I think that somebody in the classe politique, if you like, you know, the journalism, the media, the politics, the big business, ought to be willing to speak out on behalf of the little guy. And I'm astonished, for instance, that on the whole, the left-wing political parties around the world are not willing to speak out for the little guy in this particular matter. They have sided with big business. Who's going to be the beneficiary of an emissions trading scheme? The answer, of course, is the banks. Yeah. And I don't know of anybody at the moment who would like to make the banks richer than they already are, not after they've just taken the taxpayers around the West for billions to bail them out. But the emissions trading scheme is guaranteed to make banks richer and financial traders richer and all the rest of us enormously poorer, and in particular the little guy poorer, because the little guy, the ordinary working blue collar guy who keeps Australia running by going down the mines, working the power stations, driving the trains, whatever it might be, the people who actually, you know, the horny handed sons of toil who actually do the work on the back of which the rest of us are privileged to live, these working heroes, because they are heroes, these are the people who are going to be most perniciously targeted by the ETS in two ways. One, their jobs will go overseas to countries that are not going to play silly politics like this with their people's jobs. That's already happened in Britain. We've just lost 1,700 jobs in one steelworks in the north of England, shut down by Pachauri's company and transferred to India so that the British government gets carbon credits for closing down a carbon-emitting industry and sacking 1,700 of its own people. And Pachauri then transfers this business to India, where, because it's a more efficient steelworks than anything they've got in India, he gains carbon credits as well. And who pays? The taxpayers of India, the taxpayers of Britain, and all those helpless people in Britain who lost their jobs because the British government is playing exactly the same kind of political game as, I'm afraid, the Australian government is. And I think that somebody from the political class, and therefore, among others, it's going to be me, ought to be speaking out on behalf of the working guy here and saying, I don't think you should be willing to allow a government, even if it calls itself a Labour government, even if it's a government you voted for in the past, to take away your jobs in the name of the non-problem that is climate change. Because that's not fair to you, and it's not necessary to save the planet, which was, I often put it this way, was perfectly satisfactorily saved 2,000 years ago, and frankly doesn't need to be saved again.
Yes, indeed. And look, I mean, this is something that I try to explain to people who want to feel that, who feel that the global warming threat is something that we should be concerned about and do something about. And I'm always trying to steer people back to understand that, well, whether or not that's true, we have, if you look at the emissions trading schemes around the world and you look at the major corporations that have signed up to be, you know, carbon neutral, they're all the top corporations in the world. And a lot of people think that the movement is really about a grassroots movement of environmentalism, when in fact, when you look at the way it's actually being used, it's a corporate agenda. There's just vast amounts of money and investment and trading that obviously will bring a lot of money once those treaties are signed and once these emissions trading schemes completely go into law. A lot of very powerful people and very rich people will become a lot richer.
That's exactly what's going to happen. What we're going to have is a concentration of pretty much all wealth in the hands of government and its cronies in big business. This is, as I've said, it's a conspiracy in a loose sense. I'm not saying there are kind of plotters cackling in some small room somewhere saying, ha-ha, we're going to dominate the world. That's not the point. What they're doing is they're doing what everyone in the political class always tries to do, concentrate more wealth and more power in their own hands and do this on the backs of the people who increasingly become merely like slaves through excessive taxation and through excessive costs. You see, if you're a working guy, you spend a bigger proportion of your income on electrical power and on gasoline than if you're not a working guy. And so you're going to be hit by the quadrupling of electrical prices, which is what Kevin Rudd would like to achieve, the doubling of gasoline prices he would like to achieve. All of this, of course, will make governments and gasoline companies and electricity companies enormously rich, and, of course, all the traders we've talked of before. And if they get rich, they're getting rich at somebody's expense, and they're getting rich basically at your expense. And I think this is why people ought to realize just what this is going to cost and just how much this is a conspiracy, an agreement between the various powerful factions in society, all of them linked to government in various ways, the media who fawn upon government and used to regard themselves as mirrors of the establishment, but now are frankly its poodles. You've got the big corporations who, because government now dominates what they do, both by taxation and by regulation of everything they don't already tax and take straight from the pockets of corporate wealth, they're in it as well. The academic world, of course, is entirely sold on this because it depends, as to 99% of its income, on the generosity of government. So it will fawn upon government, and if government decides it wants to go this way, it will go along with it for the sake of continuing to get its subsidies. And so you get what in the 1930s would have been called fascist corporatism.
Indeed,
that's
yes.
What this actually is. It is fascism. It's, of course, not called fascism. There are not jackbooted goons walking through the streets with black or brown shirts on, but corporate fascism is what it is. And it's a very unpleasant thing to see this resurgence, because the whole idea of democracy was to make sure that no such system should ever be allowed to emerge again. And therefore, what we've got to do is to make sure that via our democratic system, we make it very plain to our ruling class that we are not prepared to tolerate this global warming nonsense any longer, not now that we know that the climate science panel of the United Nations, on which this entire scare is predicated, has been caught out in a number of corrupt scientific practices over the last few years. Let me enumerate just a few of these. First of all, when the 2007 fourth quinquennial assessment report on the climate produced by the UN's climate panel came out, on the day of publication, I noticed that there was a table of figures inserted into the document that hadn't been there in the final draft that the scientists had submitted for publication. Somebody had stuck this table of figures in, and it was a table of figures purporting to show the observed contribution of various factors to the rise in sea level over the last 40 years. And what it said was, among other things, that the observed contribution of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets was 10 times bigger than the measured result in all the literature. Somebody
right.
just multiplied it by 10 and then stuck this table in that hadn't been there before. I got straight on to four senior UN officials and said, this is entirely unacceptable. This is not the document we saw. This is to be got rid of, and you must change this, and either preferably take out this table that shouldn't be there anyway, or if you're going to have it in, at least correct this order of magnitude exaggeration and add the table up correctly. They chose the second option. Within 2 days, very furtively, they simply posted up the new version on their website without saying that they'd made any change to the original published version. There was no record in the new version saying, in the original published version, we had this table wrong, here it is now corrected. None of that. They just posted it up as if it had always been there.
Indeed. Look, we're just going to take a very, very quick break,
right?
And we'll just get straight back into some of the science. Yeah. Just stand by. Thank you. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. You're back with Truth News Radio Australia, and my name's Hereward Fenton, and today I'm interviewing Lord Christopher Monckton, who is in Australia on a tour to explain many things wrong about the official position on climate changes held by our government and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and to help recover our freedom and democracy from a creeping kind of corporatist dictatorial world government, which is slipping in under the guise of science. Lord Monckton, we were just getting in there earlier into the way in which facts continually are spun and are morphed into basically supporting the view. And I've been doing my own research into this, reading articles that come out here. And you know, our media here is just so incredibly biased. And I often, for example, I found one story recently that the headline of the story was something about the ice shelves in Antarctica being, you know, being under threat, and like that was the actual title of the story. Mm. And then I read into the story, and they quoted from the chief of the Australian Antarctic Division, but it was a very brief article and didn't really have much in it. But the headline was like, oh my God, you know, the Antarctic ice is disappearing. And what I did was I Googled the name of the scientist, and immediately I came up with another much more detailed article, in which he said that the Antarctic ice shelf has been increasing in thickness on average for at least the last 30 years. So, in fact, it was the exact opposite of what was the story that was the big scary headline.
That's right,
story.
And the rule here is don't get any of your science, whichever direction it appears to go, from the media on this. Let me just run through a few more of the errors in the IPCC's latest document, because these are the people who are charged by the world governments to get this stuff right. So we've already caught them out, putting in a table of figures that the scientists themselves hadn't put in, and multiplying by 10 the observed contribution of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets to sea level rise over the last 40 years. Now we'll move on to a graph which appears three times in full color in the current IPCC report published in 2007, which purports to show that the rate of global warming over the last 150 years has itself been accelerating, the implication being that we are causing the acceleration. Now, the truth of the matter is that in order to show that result, they took the original data and then they applied four separate, very carefully chosen trend lines to it, and then compared the trend lines one with another and said, oh, look, the more recent the period you look at, the steeper the trend line is. This is an indication that global warming is accelerating. Now, that is an entirely bogus statistical technique. I confronted Dr. Pachauri, the chairman of the IPCC, with this when he was in Copenhagen giving a lecture there. And he himself used this bogus graph, which the UN had used three times. And I said, this graph is unacceptable on any view. And it is the central graph in the whole document, because from this you are inferring that there is an acceleration in the rate of temperature increase, which there isn't. And so I said I wanted him to withdraw the graph, and he clearly didn't understand the statistical point I was making. And, of course, the reason why he didn't understand is that the chairman of the climate science panel of the UN is, in fact, a railroad engineer. He knows nothing whatsoever about the climate. And large Right. numbers of the contributors to the UN's climate panel and large numbers of the documents the climate panel cites are, in fact, documents produced by pressure groups such as the Worldwide Fund for Nature, which recently made up a statistic saying that the entire Himalayan glacier sheet would disappear by 2035, only 25 years from now. And that was picked up. It's not a peer-reviewed scientific publication. It's a propaganda publication. And it was printed in the UN's climate publication for 2007, the assessment report. And its own reviewers said, look, this is nonsense. It can't be right. But it isn't a proper peer review process. Normally, if the reviewers say, that's rubbish, you've got to justify that or take it out, you either have to justify it or take it out. In this case, the authors just said, we don't care what the reviewers say. And the lead author of that chapter, that whole chapter of the IPCC's document, has now come out and admitted that he knew that that figure was wrong. He knew that there's no danger of the Himalayan glaciers going anywhere soon, but he decided to leave that in because it would put pressure on governments. So here we're getting an admission from one of the lead authors, the senior scientist on the IPCC, that he was deliberately putting bent data into this scientific, supposedly scientific report in order to bully governments into taking steps which the scientific facts, unvarnished and unaltered, would not on their own have justified. It doesn't get much worse than that, or does it? Because the next thing that happened only this week, in fact only yesterday, the UN's climate panel has now had to admit that all of the scare stories it had been peddling for years about how there would be worse and more frequent hurricanes and more damage from hurricanes and storms and droughts and floods because of global warming has no scientific basis in fact whatsoever, and all of the evidence on that, they say, is now going to have to be reassessed. And what I've been looking at over the years in some detail is just how much warming can you expect if you double the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, as we may this century compared with 2000. And the answer is that the UN, as best I can make it out, and I've done this by a number of different methods, and it doesn't very much matter which way you do the sums, the answer comes out about the same. They appear to have exaggerated six or sevenfold the warming effect of extra CO2 in the atmosphere. And if you take away that six or sevenfold exaggeration, you also take away the climate problem, because then what you get is a gentle, sustained over time warming, which will increase the temperature of the planet by perhaps half a degree to 1 degree Celsius over the next 100 years. That's completely harmless on any view. It will not cause major disintegration of ice sheets. It will not cause droughts, floods, plagues, or anything else.
Indeed.
And so what we've got here is a series of systematic lies drawn together in a single document by a bureaucratic commission which has a vested interest, a financial vested interest, in peddling this scare, because without the scare it wouldn't exist. And let me give you an illustration of this. If we go back to the 1995 second UN assessment report, for the second time that report, just as the 1990 first assessment report had said there is no detectable human influence on global temperature at all.
Yes.
And we don't even know when we're going to find one. They said this five times. They said it plainly. They said no study has definitively established any such thing. Now, the bureaucrats on receiving that report did what they did with the 2007 report. They tampered with it. Because they said, if we put that report in and for a second time we say, actually, there doesn't seem to be a human effect on temperature at all, and that's what the whole story is about, we'll all be out of jobs. We can't go around the world doing our quarterly junkets in Bali and various other exotic locations where we can sit in the surf and swim and write rubbish science. We'll be stopped, and we have to go back to doing a real job. So they tampered with it. They called in one scientist, and they said to him, we want you to rewrite this to say the exact opposite of what the consensus in the scientific literature reported by the scientists we've chosen actually is. And so this one scientist, named Ben Santer, rewrote it. He crossed out all five of the references to no detectable human influence on the climate. He then replaced them with a sentence that said, it is now undeniable that there is a detectable human influence on the climate. And he made 200 consequential amendments so as to make it look as though that was what the report had said all along. And it was that version that was published, and it's that version that's been the official line ever since, because in the 2001 report, they said that with 66% confidence, more than half of the warming of the last 50 years was caused by humans. And in the 2007 report, with 90% confidence, they said that this was the case. But remember, all of this particular headline conclusion from the last three UN reports depends on one man turning against what was actually the consensus, not only in the scientific literature, but also among the scientists that the UN itself had chosen to write that second report. One man, and it's one man's opinion. And I wondered how they'd come to a 90% confidence that humankind was chiefly responsible for global warming over the last 50 years. And I discovered, of course, this is not a scientific conclusion. If they'd said 95% confidence and had explained what their error bars were, how they'd done the probability distributions, there might have been some sense in it. But none of that appeared. They said 90%, which is not a normal confidence interval in statistics. And so I thought, aha, I'm going to research this. So I found out that the way they had reached this 90% figure was not by the scientists, it was by the political representatives on the IPCC getting together and having a vote. That was how it was done. It has no basis in science whatsoever.
It's a political decision, and really that highlights the fact that the IPCC is a political organisation, not a scientific organisation.
Well, that's quite right, because Sir Maurice Strong, the Canadian bureaucrat who thought it up, said 25 years ago when he was setting it up that what he was doing was establishing a political body rather than a scientific body, because he hoped that one day it would be turned into a world government. And so when I read, as I did in October this year, that the September the 15th draft of what was supposed to be, but I'm glad to say now isn't, the Copenhagen Treaty, was in circulation. I got a copy of it, and I found that at paragraph 38 of Annex 1, it said there was to be a government, and the word government was used in this context of an overarching world body for the first time in any treaty I've read, and I've read quite a few in my time. I was horrified. I read further and discovered in paragraph 36 that this world government was going to be given the power to set the rules of all world markets. There'd be no such thing as a free market anymore. And so when I first revealed this treaty to the public, because they kept it carefully hidden, buried on a UN website where nobody, they hoped, would find it, where they could later claim it had always been, if anyone said, you've sprung this on us.
Yes.
I said this was a communistic treaty. Why? Because it was going to give the world government a central control over the commanding heights of the economy worldwide, with rights of enormous powers of taxation and regulation and interference in financial and other markets. And also, this was going to be not an elected body, but an unelected body. There was no mention of election or democracy or ballots or voting or the peoples of the world having the chance to choose this world government that was going to have greater powers over them than any of their own governments had had or ever could have. This was clearly either communism or fascism, doesn't matter which word you use. What I use, I think, in general, is totalitarianism. It was a rejection of the very idea that we, the people, should have any role in government at all. This, if they'd got away with it, would have been the end of government by the people, of the people, and for the people. It was going to become government of the government, by the government, and for the government, and to hell with the people.
And this gets us into the second theme I wanted to explore today, which was the agenda behind the science or the pseudoscience. And you, of course, alerted the world to this through a lot of viral YouTube videos that came out at that time, probably September, October last year.
That's right.
And, you know, we were all quite horrified to see that this was actually in the treaties. But of course, the usual reaction from the mainstream is, it's a crazy conspiracy theory. And, you know, because there's been a lot of talk of world government as a coming threat to freedom around the world. And it certainly extends beyond issues about climate change. And the problem here is that we have to be able to convince the ordinary people, and a lot of people...
I can do it in three words.
Indeed.
And this is how I've stopped a lot of the sort of left-wing commentators who are trying to divert people away from what's going on by saying, ooh, he's just another right-wing conspiracy theorist.
Yes.
And I have three words for them. Read the treaty. The draft is available at scienceandpublicpolicy.org. We've put it up there so that nobody would forget what they tried to do. And you can go there, and you go to Annex 1, paragraphs 36 to 38. There you'll find the guts of it. It's written in bureaucratic language, which you may need to get some help from a lawyer to tell you what it actually means. But what it means is they wanted to set up a world government, and that was actually a treaty in draft. It had gone through several negotiating rounds. Not a single Western democracy had stood up and said, just a moment, our people aren't going to like this, because at the moment they elect their government, and now we're proposing that an overarching world government will be on top of us, and it won't be elected. Not one. That's how close we came to democracy dying. And how did we stop it? Because I, and subsequently various others, got up and shouted blue murder. And we said, this is what's going on. Get in touch with your elected representative. And literally millions rang their senators in the United States, because it's the Senate that has to ratify such treaties by a two-thirds majority, and they said, this treaty shall not pass. We are not going to give up our constitution and our democracy for the sake of this mess of pottage using climate change as the Trojan horse. It is not acceptable to us as free, democratic Americans. And in many other nations, similar noises were made by their peoples to their governments. But I think it was in America that the strongest reaction came. And after that, probably it was Australia, because again, thanks to Alan Jones, who picked up on the YouTube video, which has now been seen by 4 or 5 million people. It's the most popular video of a political speech ever to be shown on YouTube.
Yes.
He got in touch with me and he said, will you come on our show and talk about it, which I did. And then Australians began getting in touch with their representatives and saying, this is not acceptable to us. And I think that provided part of, I'm not saying it's the main reason, of course, but part of the backdrop for the deposing of Malcolm Turnbull.
Indeed.
Who had wanted to drift along with the ETS scheme, and his replacement with Tony Abbott, who takes a much more cautious line. I think, broadly speaking, Tony Abbott's line is that he is not yet convinced that the science is as wrong as, let us say, I say it is. But he's certainly convinced, and rightly convinced, that even if the science is as right as the UN says it is, there's no economic case for doing an ETS or anything like it. And here is why. Because even if every country bound by the Copenhagen Treaty were to agree to cut its carbon emissions by as much as 30% over the next 10 years, say 15% on average, because you do it stepwise and get it up to 30%, that would account for half of world emissions. So call it 7.5% of total world emissions would have been reduced over the next 10 years to 2020. How much warming would that forestall? It's quite an easy sum. And all it would do, even if the UN is right in exaggerating what I think is the correct effect of CO2 on temperature, 6 or 7 fold, even if that's right, you're still only going to forestall a warming of 0.02 to at most 0.1 Celsius.
Yes.
Over that decade. And therefore, the best thing to do is to sit and wait. There's been no global warming for the last 15 years. Indeed, there's been global cooling for the last 9. And that doesn't match what we're being told should be happening in the models. Now, of course, it is perfectly correct to say that in a generally rising trend, you can get temperatures going down or going flat for quite long periods. That is the case. Temperatures do jump up and down a lot. But it is in the jumping up and down of the temperatures and the mismatch between that and the monotonically rising CO2 concentration, which is rising at more or less in a straight line, in fact, at the moment, at 2 parts per million per year. It's that mismatch between the stochastic, jumpy up and downy temperature trend and the very, very steady CO2 trend that the error in the UN's calculations can be most clearly discerned.
There's just a couple of points I just wanted to make there about
yeah.
that, because I've done a little bit of research into this. And for one thing, the looking at a long-term trend over a 10-year period is
yeah.
really so hopeless, because you're mostly looking at noise. So you're not really looking at a trend. You're looking at a variety of temperature measurements, which could mean anything. And the other point is that you try and investigate this. I mean, I went to the British Met Office and I went to NASA's GISS site. You actually see quite different results. And when I went to the NASA site, the way they've described the graph, it does look as if it's going straight up. But when you go to the Met Office, you can see it peaked in 1998, as you said, and went down, up a little and then down again. There seems to be I mean, a lack of consistency between the different data
well,
sets as well.
Well, you're quite right. And what I do is I take all these data sets and I plot what's called a least squares linear regression trend on any period that I want to look at. That way you get at least a halfway reliable indication of whether there is a trend. And there are simple statistical tests you can apply to find out whether the trend is significant. And here's the answer. There has been no statistically significant global warming on any measure, on any of these data sets, for the last 15 years. And there has been statistically significant global cooling on all of these measures over the last 9 years. Those are the facts. Now, at the same time, it's also true to say that the last 10 years have been the warmest 10 years in the instrumental record, because there was this very big surge in temperatures in 1998,
yes,
from which the world seems now to be gently declining. And that surge in temperatures, again, didn't relate in any way to a surge in CO2 that had caused it. It was caused by a known event called a Great El Nino that happens once every 150 years. And now what we're seeing is a gradual decline in temperatures away from that great peak. And of course, the oceans have to cool down after it, and it all takes time to kind of work its way through the system. But definitely, what we're not getting is global warming at anything like the rate predicted by the UN. Now, the rate it predicts at the moment is an increase in temperatures of as much as 0.2 Celsius degrees per decade. Now, that isn't happening. And in fact, even that forecast is a detuned forecast, because the real rate they predict is 0.35 Celsius per decade. But
right,
they've deliberately detuned it because they can see that that's not coming about. But even the detuned version, there has never been any period of a decade or more in the last 150 years at which temperature has risen even at 0.2 Celsius per decade. The best we've seen, as I say, the best, the highest we've seen, is 0.16 Celsius per decade. And that occurred between 1860 and 1880, again between 1910 and 1940, and again between 1975 and 1998. And now here's the thing. The period between 1975 and 1998 is the only period during which we could have had any influence on temperature, and yet it shows no greater a rate of increase than 1860 to 1880 and 1910 to 1940, when we could have had no effect on temperature whatsoever. And therefore, exactly as the 1995 report, before one man tampered with it, said, there is no discernible human influence on the global temperature record. You only have to look at that record to see that that is the case. And once you realize that is the case, you can then do some quite simple calculations. I'm writing a paper on this, actually, as we speak. And you can establish that it is natural changes in cloud cover that cause the jumping up and down in the short term of the temperature record, and you get these huge surges caused by sudden drops in cloud cover, which, because they don't track with changes in CO2 concentration, are unconnected with it and therefore not caused by it. These are natural changes. And if you factor in those natural changes, which go in the opposite direction from what the UN predicts in its models, then you find that climate sensitivity is indeed, as I've always calculated it to be, somewhere around a sixth to a seventh of what the UN says it is.
Yes.
And I think when I publish this next paper, it's going to be very difficult for them to get out of realizing they're going to have to do some very careful checking before they dare to come out with anything like their previous figures ever again. This is now a dying scare, and we're killing it by just doing the science more carefully than they do. And with that, I'm afraid I'm going to have to go, because I've got my next interview just about to come in.
I understand. Look, thank you so much, Lord Monckton. That's really been a great honour to have you.
Well, a real pleasure, and God bless you, and God bless Australia.
Thanks. Have a great Australia Day.
Thanks so much. Goodbye.
Cheers. Well, that was Lord Monckton. Incredible tour de force there of knowledge, learning, an amazing man. And he is going to be speaking tomorrow at the Sheraton. We'll put all that information on the show notes, and really encourage everyone to, if you're in Sydney, to come to that event at the Sheraton. And follow, if you're not able to come, follow the tour. And we've got to push this through. The ETS is set to go into Parliament very soon, as soon as Parliament comes back. And even though the Copenhagen treaty was not ultimately signed, and even though there's all of this controversy and doubt over the science, our government is still totally 100% focused on pushing this through, and they have a huge amount of support from the media, and the general public, you know, is at a disadvantage. Even though many, many people are becoming aware of this, there is still a tendency to go with what seems to be the authoritative view of things. So we have to change that. We have to be the grassroots, and we have to create that swell of opinion that basically changes the perception of what is the authoritative view. And I think what Lord Monckton has done is a really important step along that path. So I hope you enjoyed our show today, and please get back to us, leave us a message, send us an email. This is Truth News Radio Australia on Australia Day. I hope you're having a great holiday.